taller than I am.
Was he skinny or fat?
He was neither, Laura answered. He was healthy.
What was his personality? Emma asked next. Was he serious? Was he funny?
Laura thought about this for a moment. He was quite amusing, she answered. Spirited.
Spirited? Emma repeated.
He had a fun, silly side. They were quiet. The road made a recurring bumping sound beneath the car.
No more, Emma said.
No more what?
I don't want to know anything more.
I understand, Laura told her.
Ever, Emma said.
I won't bring it up again, Laura promised. I don't like this, Laura frowned.
Your tea? Emma asked.
No, I don't like saying goodbye to you in a coffee shop.
It was your idea, Emma reminded her, taking a sip of her water.
Laura looked out the window. Emma's school was through the trees down the road. They'd already been there, checked in, met the roommate, and unpacked. Laura had been about to leave when she'd had a thought. It would be easier to say goodbye in a public place, to keep herself in check in case she got emotional. Now the two of them were seated at a rickety iron table in a coffee shop, their emotions very much in check, and it was terrible. Well, I guess this is it, Laura said as they stepped outside. Emma crossed her arms and looked at the ground. Laura realized she was doing the same. Can I please drive you back to campus?
Mom, Emma groaned. I told you I want to walk.
Are you sure? Emma nodded and kicked a pine cone.
I'll walk you to your car, though.
It was a small parking lot. They were there in 30 seconds. Laura stood on her tiptoes to give Emma a kiss on the cheek goodbye.
You're so much taller than me.
You always say that, Emma said wearily. Well, it always takes me by surprise. Emma rolled her eyes. You know, you're lucky to be so tall, Laura said. It's tough being a little shrimp like me. People don't take you seriously. Laura unlocked the door but paused before opening it. Parents' weekend will be here before we know it, she said with cheerful conviction. Emma made a face that was a cross between sarcasm and agreement. I'm not kidding. 6 weeks may seem like a long time, but it'll go by lickety-split. Laura snapped her fingers to convey how quickly it would go by. Emma waved a hand in the air to indicate she was about to be on her way. This was it, the last time she'd see her for a while, in a parking lot. No, Laura shouted. You're not walking. I'm the parent, and I make the rules, and you're getting in the car and I'm driving you, and that's that. To Laura's surprise, Emma surrendered and climbed in the passenger seat. Laura commented on the beauty of the surrounding trees for the 2-minute drive, but Emma only grunted in response, until they pulled into the driveway of her school.
Was he Swedish? Emma's voice cracked. That's why you told people that story?
Laura's heart sank, anticipating Emma's disappointment.
It's possible his ancestors were from Sweden, she said.
Laura didn't have much of an appetite and decided to have a bowl of bran for dinner. When she was done, she carried the bowl to the sink and gave it a quick rinse. She was about to put it in the dishwasher when she realized there would be fewer dishes from now on. Dishwashers used a lot of energy, and she did not like to run theirs until it was completely full. With Emma gone, it would take a while for this to happen. She turned the faucet back on and gave the bowl a thorough scrub, dried it off with a dish towel, and left it out on the counter. There was no point in returning it to the shelf with the others. She would use the same one for breakfast. That first morning, riding the 6 train to work, Laura felt as though she'd tapped into a sadness that was larger than her own, the collective loneliness, disappointment, and despair of all the people who'd ever ridden through the bowels of the New York City subway system. If the other passengers noticed that she was crying, they pretended not to, which Laura appreciated. People who thought New Yorkers were cold and uncaring
didn't understand that in a city like this, one's physical proximity to strangers necessitated a respect of their psychological privacy. By the time Laura reached her station, she had recovered. The sadness had had to do with saying goodbye to Emma, and she was glad she'd gotten it out of her system. As she ascended the steps, a cathartic levity set in as she considered the possibilities that lay before her. "It will be a new chapter of your life," people told her. "Grief is like a water balloon," someone had told Laura after Bibbs had died. "You have a certain amount of it in you, and it drips out until one day all that's left is a shriveled-up balloon with nothing inside it." Laura thought that balloon had emptied years ago, but in the wake of Emma's departure, it seemed to bubble back to life. Thoughts of Emma were interspersed with those of her mother. Long-forgotten scenes of Bibbs, which, in contrast to the memories that had precipitated after her death, featured happy times that left her full of tender fondness. Some of them were so strange, so whimsical, she was sure she must have dreamed them or made them up. For instance, the time Bibbs had taken a string and strung it around the leg of a dragonfly she'd found in the garden, and they'd taken turns holding the end of the string as it circled above their heads like a kite. How was that even possible? And yet Nicholas claimed to remember it, too. It would take some getting used to, having Emma gone. In the meantime, Laura decided it would be good to switch up her routines a bit, to try new things. 4 nights passed before Laura heard from Emma. The first few phone calls were brief and perfunctory. "Hello? Hi. How was your day?" "Good. Good. Just calling to say goodnight." "Okay." But then, one night, Emma confessed she was having trouble sleeping. She missed the sounds of the city. It was so quiet up there at night, too quiet to sleep. The urge to sleep wouldn't hit till the day, when she'd walk around in a delirious stupor. Traveling through campus, you were expected to smile and say hi to each person you passed. This was exhausting and made her feel phony. She wished she were a llama. "Why a llama?" Laura asked. After a prolonged silence came a muffled sob. "Because they never have to make friends with new llamas," Emma said. "Or if they do, they don't get upset about it." "I know what you mean," Laura said. "I remember I sometimes used to get jealous of our dog, Mr. Baggins. He was always fed and taken care of. People loved him. He didn't know he was going to die someday. And he never really got sad, or at least not sad the way people do." "He didn't know he was going to die someday?" Emma said. "I thought you were trying to cheer me up. Now I'm thinking about how we're all going to die." "Sorry, you're right." To distract Emma from dark thoughts, Laura started talking about her day. As she rambled on, the receiver grew moist and warm against her skin, which came to feel like Emma's silent presence, the sticky heat of her sadness. When Laura ran out of things to talk about, she proposed she read a book out loud over the phone. She walked over to the bookshelf and pulled out one of Emma's childhood favorites, Roald Dahl's The BFG, which, and Laura hadn't even remembered this, began with a description of a girl in a dormitory who couldn't sleep. "Do you want me to stop?" Laura asked, after the first chapter, not having heard any encouraging signals from Emma. "No," Emma said. "Keep going." For the past few years, Margaret had been badgering Laura to get her hair colored. The grays were proliferating. There was no denying it. Laura arrived early to her hair appointment. She forgot to bring her book, and there was no newspaper in the reception area, just glossy magazines. The cover of one featured a topless woman, presumably promoting some movie, holding her hands over her breasts like a bra. Out of boredom, Laura picked it up and flipped to the page promising to share this woman's beauty secrets. According to the article, the woman was 40, and she had spent her entire life avoiding the sun, hence her beautiful, unblemished complexion. Laura felt depressed thinking of her own skin. All her life, she'd been under the impression the sun's damage was limited to cancer and liver spots, but her dermatologist had recently told her it also wore down the skin's elasticity, which is how wrinkles developed. Marco, The renowned colorist Margaret had sent her to shook Laura's hand and led her to his station. As she took a seat, he complimented Laura's gray. He said it was a particular variety, more like silver, and that he thought it was becoming.
"Once you start coloring, you can't go back," he warned her.
Coming from a professional, Laura took this to heart. She did not end up coloring her hair that day, but she did stop at a newsstand to purchase a copy of The Village Voice. That evening, as she combed the classifieds, her eyes drifted over the personals, where one of the ads called for someone who cares about the fate of the planet and believes there's a special place in hell for Newt Gingrich. Laura chuckled at this final criterion and was surprised that the poster, a 46-year-old atheist public defender, described his body as petite. Then she saw it was listed under the F-seeking F category. The Parkview was just one of many high-rises that had sprung up around them in recent years. While the buildings were still under construction, giant billboards would announce their name, followed by a list of their amenities. Across the street, occupying the lot where the tenements used to be, was the Monterey, which boasted a swimming pool, roof deck, and 24-hour concierge. As the property values of the apartments in Laura's building increased, some of the old-timers cashed out. The shifting demographic of the residents of the building, younger, more entitled, was reflected in the lobby, where the co-op board had voted to replace the super's religious-themed paintings with floor-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall mirrors. Laura passed by one of these mirrors on her way home one night, and her face looked particularly weathered. She peered closer before going upstairs to investigate. Maybe the lighting was just unflattering. She undressed before the full-length mirror in her front hall closet to assess the damage. The lobby lighting had indeed been harsh, but there was no denying it. Years of sunbathing had taken their toll, and not just on her face, but other parts of her body as well. Though she'd never gained any weight in her midsection, her stomach was soft. As she ran her hands across it, it reminded her of the shell of a tart after the berries had been plucked off and the cream licked away. What a waste. All those tans, with no one to admire the results. She took a step back, dimmed the hall light, and mimicked the pose of the woman on the cover of the magazine. The results were much more attractive than before. Her skin looked tight and smooth. You couldn't tell that her breasts drooped and that Emma had destroyed her nipples. As she stood there, studying herself from different angles, she became aroused, which didn't make any sense. She was looking at herself, but it felt good, and she couldn't help it, and she didn't stop. Imagining someone else was watching, she kept doing what she was doing, periodically dimming the light even more until it was dark. She was getting ready to leave for work when the doorbell rang. It was a man Laura didn't recognize. He looked to be in his mid-twenties, chubby, bearded.
"Martin," he said, offering her a sweaty palm. "I live downstairs, right below you, 16A.
Martin was having some friends over that night, he explained, and the last time they were over, they'd complained he didn't have any chairs. Did she have any he could borrow? "How many do you need?" Laura asked as he followed her into the kitchen.
"I'll take what you've got," he said. "As many as you can spare."
"Is 5 okay?" She had 6 chairs.
5 works," Martin nodded, stroking his beard. "Though, if it doesn't make a difference to you, 6 would actually be better."
Laura, who was already running behind, helped him carry the 6 chairs out to the hall. She was about to shut the door behind him when he said,
"Wait, I don't think I caught your name."
In her flustered rush to wrap up their encounter, Laura accidentally responded with the name she'd used in her brief correspondence with the public defender. Liza. Laura made plans to meet the public defender for dinner on the Upper West Side. While waiting outside the restaurant, she ran into a bride she'd worked with years ago. The groom, Andrew, had been a classmate of Nicholas's, but Laura couldn't recall this woman's name. After an awkward exchange of, "Hello, nice to see you, how are you?" Laura, in an attempt to wrap things up, said to send her best to Andrew, and the woman laughed.
Actually, we got divorced, and no, he didn't cheat, she said. Turns out, I'm a lesbian.
With a nod and a quick farewell, the woman turned and entered the restaurant.
Laura felt terrible, but she couldn't carry through with it, not with this woman whom she knew, and so she left.
Or stood her up, as the saying went. Laura didn't mind eating breakfast standing at the counter, but dinner was another thing. She wrote Martin a note and slipped it beneath his front door. 5 minutes later, her doorbell rang, and it was Martin, holding a chair.
Dude, he said, handing it to her. I'm so sorry. Things have been really busy. I got this new job repairing voting machines, and I completely forgot.
He shook his head remorsefully.
That's no excuse, though. I feel like a jerk.
Don't worry, Laura told him. Martin asked if he could hold on to the other chairs until Wednesday.
I think that's all right, Laura said. Yes, I don't think I'll be needing them before that.
When exactly will you be needing them? Martin inquired.
When she hosted her next dinner party. Were there any on the calendar?
No, there weren't.
In that case, could he just hold on to them? He hosted this meeting every Tuesday evening, Martin explained. Anywhere from 1 to 2 dozen people showed up. It was hard to predict. Some of them were his age. They could sit on the floor. But there were also some older folks he wanted to be comfortable. Last time they'd complained a little.
Was he asking to keep her chairs?
Laura didn't know what to say. She wanted to laugh. People like this infuriated and fascinated her. The takers of the world, they felt no anxiety making all sorts of requests. In her experience of dealing with them, they also appeared unembarrassed by being told no, because it meant just that and nothing more to them. That is asking too much. You are inconveniencing me. I'm not comfortable giving you my chairs because I don't even know you. These weren't projected fears that would keep them up at night. How am I going to get chairs for free in an easy manner that doesn't require hauling them through the streets of Manhattan? This was their concern.
If you could return the chairs this weekend, Laura told him, I would appreciate it.
Kandusky, Martin said with a confident nod.
Excuse me, Laura said.
No problem, Martin told her, ringing for the elevator. Happy to bring the chairs back Sunday.
After a few weeks, Emma's homesickness began to subside, but she continued to call every night. During the day, Laura would make a mental inventory of amusing or interesting tidbits to tell her. At first, they weren't terribly amusing or interesting to Emma.
Hmm, Emma said, after Laura relayed a client's demand to have her cake decorated with edible gold foil.
That's gross. But when Laura told her later about an exchange she'd overheard between a young boy and his mother on the subway, he'd whispered in her ear, and she'd loudly replied,
What? Your balls hurt?
Emma laughed, her first real laugh since she'd left home, it seemed. Laura began tailoring her anecdotes to her sensibility. And so they became two people who talked on the phone, like friends. Laura's friendship with Margaret was one of the constants in her life. There had been times when she'd taken it for granted, or thought less than generously of her, but now, more than ever, she took comfort in knowing that for better or worse, Margaret would always be there. For Laura's 45th birthday, Margaret wanted to throw her a dinner party, but upon seeing the guest list and thinking of all the enthusiasm she would have to manufacture for the evening, Laura demurred.
I think it would be more fun just the two of us, she said.
Okay, but I insist you let me take you somewhere fancy for once.
They made a reservation for two at Tavern on the Green. The morning of Laura's birthday, Margaret called to ask if they could switch it to lunch. Laura hesitated. The food at Tavern on the Green wasn't anything special. The whole point of going was for all the lights on the trees, which could be seen only at night.
I'm sorry, Margaret said. I know it's not the same in the daylight.
No, no, Laura said. It's fine. Lunch is actually better for me. It was a beautiful Indian summer day. Short sleeves weather, maybe the last of the season.
An hour before they were supposed to meet, Laura called to propose they scrap their plan and pick up sandwiches and eat on the lawn in the back of the Met.
"How's Emma liking her school?" Margaret asked, flapping out the blanket she had brought on the grass and taking a seat.
"She's actually doing really well," Laura said.
"I'm so glad," Margaret responded. "Charlotte, as I'm sure you've heard, has been suspended."
Laura shook her head. "I'm pretty much out of the Winthrop loop," she said, realizing it as she spoke it.
"For 2 weeks," Margaret added.
Winthrop rarely suspended students. Laura tried not to look shocked. They sat facing the road that ran through the park. Behind them was a wall of glass, the windowed facade of the Egyptian wing. Across the lawn, a woman in her 20s stripped down to a bikini and lay on the grass with a book.
"Well," Margaret said, "aren't you curious to know what she did?"
"What did she do?"
"My wonderful daughter, in her infinite wisdom, coerced a classmate into flashing the hot dog man. It was part of an initiation ritual." She made air quotes with her fingers.
"Initiation to what?" Laura asked.
"The funny pink bunnies."
"The funny pink bunnies?"
"The funny pink bunnies," Margaret said authoritatively. "It's the name of their group."
"So she's at home right now?"
"Oh, no," Margaret said with a smirk. "She's on her hands and knees planting daffodil bulbs in Morningside Park."
"Of her own accord?" Laura was impressed.
"You kidding?" Margaret made a face. "I made some calls, signed her up with a program that works with juvenile delinquents from Harlem."
"That should be interesting for her," Laura said.
"It's not a punitive boot camp thing," Margaret explained. "It's about self-esteem. It helps kids feel good about themselves through work."
Laura nodded.
"That makes sense."
Margaret unwrapped her sandwich.
"Trip began acting up at this age. Took him years to get his act together as an adult. And he realizes now it was because he didn't feel good about himself, because he never had to work for anything."
"That makes sense," Laura repeated, because she couldn't think of what else to say. A man with a lizard draped over his shoulder strolled by, catching the attention of the sunbather, who looked up from her book to stare.
"In other news, I'm pregnant," Margaret said.
She laughed at Laura's bewildered expression.
12 weeks.
"You're not kidding," Laura said, as Margaret pulled her shirt back to reveal a little bump. How did this happen?"
"The old-fashioned way," Margaret said. "Don't ask me why it worked now, when I'm 44 years old. It was an accident. Or a surprise, Janet says I'm supposed to say. My OBGYN says I'm a medical miracle."
"Oh, Mags," Laura said, "this is wonderful news. Have you told Charlotte yet?"
Margaret took a bite of her sandwich and shook her head. "She's about to find out," she said, holding a hand over her mouth as she chewed. "That's actually why I had to change our plans. We'd been holding off until I made it through the first trimester, but I just saw my doctor and he says everything looks good." She swallowed. "Trip's been in Houston for business, and I wanted to wait for him to get back so we can tell her together tonight."
"How exciting for her," Laura said.
"I hope so," Margaret said pensively. "Yes, I think it will be."
"So Janet knows," Laura said.
Margaret nodded.
"What about Edith? Does she know yet?" Laura's cheerfully casual tone rang false.
Margaret took another bite.
"Mm-hmm."
"Well, this is very exciting," Laura said. "I'm very, very happy for you."
She took a tiny bite of her sandwich but had trouble swallowing.
"I'm fine," she said, realizing Margaret was looking at her.
"I truly am happy for you. It really is a miracle. A miracle, baby. I don't know why." She dabbed her eyes. "Maybe
I'm a little upset. I'm not the first to know.
Laura mustered a smile as she blinked back tears.
I know it's silly. It's just that, well, when something happens to me, you're the first person I tell. Usually, the only person.
Margaret looked distressed and unsure of how to respond.
You know, I think it's a birthday thing, Laura told her. I've always been a bit of an Eeyore on my birthday.
Margaret rested a hand on her shoulder.
You know I love you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura said. She was caught off guard by the pronouncement. I do, too, she said quietly a moment later.
Neither of them spoke for a little while.
That's what I'll look like at my poor child's high school graduation. Margaret pointed to an elderly, slumped-over woman being pushed in a wheelchair.
Look at this thing on my arm.
Margaret held up her wrist.
I noticed it just this morning. Do you think it looks suspicious?
It looks like a freckle, Laura said.
But freckles don't just grow overnight.
You've always been afraid of death, Laura reflected, ever since we were little.
Isn't everyone? Margaret asked.
I'm more worried about the Earth, Laura said. I don't want it to be destroyed from global warming.
Margaret made a skeptical pfft sound.
One evening, just as they were about to say goodnight, Emma said, Oh, yeah, Mom, I need you to do me a favor that involves doing your least favorite thing.
What's my least favorite thing? Laura asked.
Shopping, Emma replied. I need you to send me a new pair of jeans.
Okay, but what's wrong with the pair we just bought you before you left?
They don't fit me anymore.
Oh, no, Laura said. Shit.
Emma wasn't eating enough. She was running too much. Dr. Marks was right. She wasn't able to keep tabs on her in Vermont.
What's wrong?
You were a size 2 when you left, Laura said.
Well, I'm not anymore.
Emma's tone was curt. Whatever Laura said would further irritate her. To comment on the matter was to risk being hung up on. It was like trying to grasp the end of a chain that had slipped down the drain of the sink. There was no other way to retrieve it, but touching it might send it into the abyss.
I'll see if I can pick up a size 0 tomorrow, Laura said.
Mom! Emma groaned.
I'm not anorexic. My jeans don't fit anymore because they're too tight.
Oh! Laura tried to hide the excitement in her voice.
And what size do you want me to get?
A 4, Emma said. The uphill trail running has made my leg muscles grow.
Laura was in the basement, putting her clothes in the dryer, when she heard a voice from behind her.
What's a person like you doing in a place like this?
Sorry if I scared you, Martin said, dumping a trash bag of clothes into one of the machines. Always thought it would be funny to say that to someone down here. This basement's so creepy. Very Silence of the Lambs.
I never saw it, Laura said, returning Martin's smile and turning the dryer on.
As she left the laundry room and headed through the poorly lit dungeon-like tunnel that led to the elevator, she heard the echo of Martin's voice.
Shit, shit, shit.
A moment later came the lumbering shuffle of socked feet.
Forgot detergent, he said as he caught up to her.
I have some upstairs, Laura told him.
Yeah, me too. Just annoying to have to go all the way back up and get it.
Up and down, Martin said, stepping in the elevator. The elevator of life. Down and up, up and down all day long, and the fun never ends.
Martin, Laura said as they approached his floor, when you bring the chairs back on Sunday, could you please bring them back by 9 p.m.? I'd like to go to bed early because I've been having trouble sleeping recently.
Kandusky, Martin said.
What does that mean? Laura asked. Is that Polish?
Polish? Martin smiled. No, can-do-ski. No worries. It'll happen. I can do it.
Oh, Laura said. I like that.
The first week of October, Emma started mentioning Jill, and also a boy named Lucas. Laura couldn't tell if the latter was a romantic interest. From the stories, it sounded like the three of them spent a lot of time together.
"Maybe you shouldn't come parents' weekend," Emma said.
"Why not?" Laura had been looking forward not only to visiting Emma, but also to seeing Vermont's autumn foliage.
"Jill's parents aren't coming, and I was going to keep her company all weekend."
"She's welcome to come to dinner with us," Laura said. "Lucas, too."
"I think it might make me sad again if I see you now," said Emma.
"I get it," Laura said.
"Hey, stranger," came Martin's voice down the cereal aisle of Associated Value.
The excitement on his face suggested they'd just crossed paths in an international airport. He had forgotten to return the chairs on Sunday, but surely seeing her now would remind him.
"You shaved off your beard," Laura said. "I almost didn't recognize you."
"I'm joining the army."
Laura was speechless.
"Just kidding," he laughed. "I lost a bet, but I had you, admit it. For a second, I had you."
"For a second," Laura conceded. After paying for her groceries, Laura discovered Martin waiting for her by the store's exit. They walked home together.
"Did you know the dude who used to live in my apartment?" Martin asked, squinting up at their building as they waited for the light.
"Mr. Emery," Laura smiled fondly. "He always wore a hat, even on the hottest day of the year. Toodaloo," he would say when he got off the elevator.
"Did you know he croaked in the apartment?" was how Martin followed this up.
"I was aware that he died," Laura responded.
"But you didn't know that he died inside the apartment and wasn't discovered for 3 days?
Laura shook her head. She had no interest in hearing the details of Mr. Emery's death.
"Don't you find that strange," Martin said with a frown, "that a guy living 10 feet below you could just die, and you'd have no idea he was just laying there dead?"
"He was a very old man," said Laura. They passed James in his usual spot on the corner. They both waved, and James called out,
"No more beard!" "Joining the army," Martin hollered.
"Yeah, right, man," James cackled. "They'd never take you."
"Manhattan apartments are a weird place to die," Martin said as they entered the lobby. "The coordinated effort to dispose of the body in the fastest, most discreet way possible, with service elevators and back entrances and unmarked vehicles." "I wouldn't want to die in Manhattan, period," he said as the elevator arrived.
"Where would you like to die?" Laura asked as they stepped in. It was a weird question. She wasn't sure why she'd asked it.
"I don't know."
Martin pushed his glasses up his nose and folded his arms across his belly as he considered this.
"Somewhere in the country? A small town where everyone knows me, and the mayor declares a holiday so everyone can attend my funeral, and there's a kind of parade through the streets afterward."
"A parade?"
"You know, a brass band, a decked-out hearse, maybe a float with a giant papier-mâché statue of me."
Laura giggled. She wasn't entirely sure he was kidding.
"As far as my coffin, I'd like..."
Martin rubbed his chin and shook his head.
"Scratch the coffin. Save the tree. I'd be, like, dressed in a tux, a baby blue tux, and then I'd like to be, what's it called, that kind of puppet with the strings?"
"A marionette?" Laura said.
"Yeah."
Martin smiled and nodded.
"I'd like to be tied up like that, strings attached to sticks that will be manipulated by the pallbearers so that I'm lowered into the grave in a way that looks like I'm dancing while everyone in the village sings, 'For he's a jolly good fellow.'" "What do you think?" Martin said as the elevator arrived on his floor. "Do you think that's too much?"
"It's quite an image," Laura responded.
"So," Martin said, thrusting his hand out of the elevator to keep the door from closing. "How things going with you? Anything new?"
"Not particularly," Laura said, wondering if she should mention the chairs or wait for him to remember on his own.
their calls got shorter and less frequent. By Halloween, nearly all of them were initiated by Laura. Sensing Emma was in a rush to get off, she kept her updates to a minimum, and instead of asking questions that would prolong the exchange, she'd simply affirm the gist of whatever Emma had told her. "Well, I think Lucas sounds very nice," she said at the end of one of their chats.
"In case you're wondering, we're not a thing," Emma replied.
"He's not a boyfriend?"
"No," she said. "He's obsessed with Seth."
"Your running coach?"
"For the millionth time, it's cross-country."
"Cross-country coach," Laura corrected herself. "Lucas is romantically interested in him?"
"Yeah," Emma said. "He's bisexual."
"I see," Laura said, impressed by how casually the term rolled off Emma's tongue. "So he's romantically interested in both women and men."
"Yes, Mom, he's romantically interested in both genders. That's what bisexual means. Do you have a problem with that? Do you think that makes him a freak?"
"Of course not," Laura quipped. "Who do you think I am?" The Sunday before Thanksgiving, Emma told Laura she'd been invited to spend Thanksgiving break with Lucas's family, who lived an hour from the school.
"It's okay if I say yes?" Emma asked. "I know it's last minute. I said I'd ask first. I can come home if you want."
10 weeks had seemed like a long time to go without seeing Emma. Now it would be 13.
"I think that sounds nice," Laura told her. "You should go." "But what about you? What will you do?"
"I'll go to 136, she said. "What else would I do?"
"Yeah, but will Stephanie and Nicholas be there?"
"They'll be in Florida."
"It'll just be you and Doug Doug?"
"And Ellen Lowe."
"Who's that?"
"Mrs. Lowe, you remember her. We used to see her on Goat Hill walking her dogs."
"The woman you said probably spent more money on her dog's cashmere sweaters than your entire wardrobe cost?"
"I don't remember saying that, and I doubt they're actually cashmere, but yes, that's her."
"That's random," Emma said. "Why'd you invite her?"
"I didn't. Douglas did. They've become companions."
"Companions?" Emma repeated with disdain.
"They meet for dinner. They do things together."
"So it'll just be you three?"
"That's correct."
"Who's cooking?" Emma asked. "Are you making the turkey?"
Laura wondered why she was asking this as though she were a co-worker. "I think you know the answer to that question," she told Emma. "Sandra is."
"Well, you know what I think, Mom? I think it's a little ironic, not to mention fucked up, to make an immigrant cook a Thanksgiving turkey for you."
"I'm not sure how I'm supposed to respond to that." Laura reached for the last of the peanut butter Ritz crackers she'd made herself for dinner. "I hear that you're upset, and I'm not sure what you want me to say."
"What I want you to say? Are you serious, Mom? That's what our conversations are? You wondering, how does she want me to answer? Tell her what she wants to hear. So, basically, our whole relationship is fake, like a game of dolls."
"Don't be ridiculous, darling. Of course it's not," Laura said. She wasn't sure where this was going. She feared she was being entrapped. "What does that even mean, a game of dolls?"
"You make the doll say what you want her to say."
Laura sighed. Anything she said would be used against her. There was no winning in these situations.
"Mom," Emma spoke after a staticky silence, "are you still there?"
"Of course I am."
"Then talk to me," Emma shouted. "Talk to me like a real person. Say what you're actually thinking."
"What I was actually thinking," Laura said, "was that I agree. But you know my father."
"Your father," Emma ridiculed in her mock English accent.
"You know Doug Doug," Laura said,
It's his house and he likes to do things a certain way.
Laura looked at the clock. It was almost 10.
It's getting late, she told Emma. I should let you go.
Not tired, Emma answered, suddenly composed.
You want to stay on the phone and keep talking?
There was a pause.
What are we doing right now? Why would you ask me that, Mom?
Laura sighed. Well, she said, it doesn't really sound like you want to stay on the phone and keep talking.
What does it sound like?
Laura's hand tightened around the phone. To be honest, you seem a little combative, not so much interested in having a conversation, more wanting to pick a fight, and it's late, and I'm tired, and not in the mood.
Well, good night to you, Emma said tersely. So sorry for keeping you up.
She hung up. When Laura called her back, Emma picked up after the first ring.
Mama, she wept through the receiver. You can't make me feel guilty. You have no right. All I'm asking for, all I ever wanted, her voice quivered, all I ever, ever wanted was to have a normal Thanksgiving, where we spend the day in our kitchen making our own food and set on our own table like every other family in America.
Dial tone. This time when Laura called back, she did not answer.
Emma, she spoke to her answering machine. My dear little M.
Laura looked over at their table with its lone chair at the end.
I get it, she continued. I understand.
I'm sorry I couldn't give that to you, she said, before gently placing the phone in its cradle. Martin opened his door holding a carton of rainbow sherbet.
This is really embarrassing, he said, licking the spoon. But the first time you told me your name, I wasn't really paying attention.
Laura, she told him.
You can call me Marty, he said.
Marty? Laura began. I'm here about the chairs. I'd like them back.
The chairs!
He knocked his head with his fist. Totally forgot I still had them. My bad. Place is a little messy, he said, letting her in. In all her years of living in the penthouse of 166, Laura had never stepped inside another resident's apartment, and she was surprised by how small Martin's was, a quarter the size of hers. It felt even smaller, as it was cluttered with stacks of records and an antique phonograph, milk crates full of books, a stationary bike, a movie theater popcorn machine, and a cactus, among other things. There wasn't much in the way of furniture, apart from her chairs, which were lined up haphazardly at the other end of the room facing the window.
You're up late, Martin said,
clearing a path to reach them.
Likewise, Laura said.
Martin yawned.
Actually, just starting my day.
Need help bringing them up? He asked once all the chairs were in the hall outside his door.
That would be nice, Laura told him.
As they waited for the elevator, Martin said,
I hope I didn't disturb you with that whole dancing corpse business that other time in the elevator. Sometimes my mind goes to dark places.
Laura smiled and shook her head to dismiss his concern, but Martin continued in this vein.
I get depression, he told her. Part of my trouble following through with things.
Laura wasn't sure how to respond to this. She offered him a neutral expression and a nod, in what she hoped conveyed compassion and non-judgment.
Is your new job night hours?
Fixing voting machines, she added, when Martin looked unsure of what she was referring to.
Oh, that was just a 3-day gig.
He yawned again and then asked brightly, Know anyone looking for a banjo teacher or a juggler for kids' birthday parties? Or a really awesome screenplay about a guy who wakes up one day and has completely forgotten what language is, so he has to find other ways to communicate?
It's a comedy, he added.
Suddenly the walls that had contained Laura's irritation collapsed. She looked in his face and saw a fragility. He seemed more like a boy than a man, idealistic,
full of foolish expectations of what his future would hold. She couldn't see his life unfolding accordingly, and it broke her heart to imagine his disappointment. She thought of him as an old man, and then of his mother holding him as a baby, and she couldn't bear it. Laura shook her head. "I'm afraid I don't, Marty, but I will certainly keep an ear open." The elevator arrived. They loaded the chairs and rode up.
"Wait, how long have I had these chairs for?" Martin asked as they stepped into Laura's kitchen.
"Don't worry," Laura told him. "It's just been knee, so it hasn't been a problem."
"But when did I borrow them?"
"Maybe the beginning of October," Laura said, though she knew it was really the end of September.
"That's over a month," Martin shook his head in remorse. "God damn, I feel like a jerk, a big fat buck."
"Don't say that," Laura said. "No, you aren't."
"Laura, I want you to promise me something."
A serious look came over Martin's face.
"If something like this happens again in the future, you have to say something."
Laura smiled and shook her head to reassure him.
"I mean it," he said. "Speak up."
She smiled again. As Martin stepped out the door to wait for the elevator, she said, "My mother had depression." Martin nodded thoughtfully. "It's funny, because no one knew it. When she died, all the condolence letters talked about how she was the happiest person they knew. Joie de vivre, life of the party, lit up a room." The elevator arrived.
"Bipolar?"
he asked, sticking his hand over the sensor to keep the door from closing. "I believe she was diagnosed with that at some point," she said. "We don't really name things in our family."
Martin grinned. "Let me guess, you're from the Midwest?"
Laura shook her head.
"Sorry," he said. "That's kind of an insult."
Laura considered this. "I don't know why you say that," she said. "The people I've met from the Midwest I've liked very much."
"Thanks," Martin said. "I'm from St. Louis. What about you? Where are you from?"
"East 65th Street," Laura said, "between Lex and 3rd. Martin looked surprised.
"You don't seem like you grew up in New York City."
Laura had been told this before. She never knew if it was a compliment or not. "Born and raised," she said. She thought about adding 7th generation, as Nicholas was fond of telling people, but thought it would sound obnoxious. After locking the door behind her, Laura brushed her teeth, put on her nightgown, and got into bed. She read for a bit, turned off the light, and fell asleep. There was a word for it, the anxious thoughts of the pre-dawn hours. It was an old English word that no one used anymore, and having recently learned it, Laura had already forgotten what it was. It began with a U, and the rest of the letters were strange. Uticare. Something like that. Nevertheless, it comforted her, the mere fact of its existence many centuries ago, to think of waking up in the middle of the night and being unable to fall back asleep as less of a unique affliction than a universal thing. Part of the human condition. Tonight, she'd gotten out of bed and been standing by her bedroom window at the precise moment the Empire State Building went dark. It surprised her that in all her years of being awake at this hour, she'd never witnessed this event. As a child, Emma had often wondered and asked about this. The light on the top of the Empire State Building, when did it get turned off? Whose job was it? Did he sleep in the Empire State Building?
"I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm afraid I can't answer that."
Laura had always imagined it went off in a blink, but it was a gradual dimming. And when it was done, she continued to stand by the window looking out at all the other buildings, which were mostly dark, except for a spattering of illuminated windows. She thought of the people who were still up and wondered what they were doing. Laura returned to bed and drifted off to sleep for another hour, and this time, when she woke up to the clanking of pipes and the hiss of the radiator, she could see nothing out her window. Just a blank canvas of a color there was no word for. A metallic pink mixed with gray. There was a flutter in her chest, as there always was upon spotting the season's first snowflakes,
but this was more than the typical debut flurry. It was coming down hard. It was sticking.
Laura put a turtleneck on over her nightgown. Then she put on 3 pairs of knee socks, a trick she'd learned as a child. If you put on 3 pairs of socks and went outside in the freshly fallen dry snow, your feet didn't get cold, and it felt like walking barefoot on a beach. As she passed by her bookshelf on her way out of the bedroom, she saw the tin box in its usual spot. She paused, took a step back, and picked it up. She went to the kitchen, opened the door, and stepped out onto the terrace. Laura had never handled ashes before. They were more tangible than she'd expected. She thought they would be like powder, that all she'd have to do was uncurl her fingers, and the wind would whisk them away in a whispery, vaporous tendril, as it was doing to the snow. But these ashes were chunky and uneven, like what you'd find in the bottom of a fireplace or charcoal grill. She flung a handful over the railing. She scooped up another handful and another. Soon, she was clutching an empty tin. She had expected something more out of this moment, for something dramatic, whimsical, or amusing to happen, or for the ashes to float upward to the heavens. That Bibbs did not make herself known during the scattering of her ashes, that they unceremoniously sank to the street, seemed to confirm the fact that she was really gone. When Laura turned to go back in, the door wouldn't budge. She pushed harder. It still didn't open. She pushed and pushed, thrusting her full weight against it, but it remained stuck, as often happened in the hottest and coldest weather. The windows were all latched shut, and it was impossible to shatter double-glazed windows. The man who'd installed them had proudly demonstrated this to her as proof of their superb insulation. She tried with her legs, gripping the railing for support, her kicks becoming more frantic as they continued to fail. People didn't freeze to death on penthouse terraces in Manhattan. Eventually, the snow would peter out, and the yuppies of the Parkview, Normandy Court, or the Monterey would wake up and look out the windows and see her. She would catch the attention of a pedestrian, or the pilot of a traffic helicopter. Someone would notice her and recognize that she needed assistance. There was a ladder leading up to the roof. It would increase the chances of being seen. She climbed up. Laura had never been on the roof before. It felt unsafe. There was no railing. It was not a place people were supposed to be. Now she was scared. She turned to go back down the ladder, but she wasn't sure what direction it was. The snow had thickened and she'd become disoriented. She couldn't see where the roof ended and the sky began. The visibility was so bad, she could be anywhere. A ski lift in Vermont, a mountain in the Alps, halfway to the moon, where rogue particles barreled aimlessly through the soft, white violence of infinity. She stood there, shivering, stomping her feet, waving her arms above her head. But it was in vain. How could anyone see her? She could barely make out her own hand before her. She stopped waving. But she had to keep moving to stay warm. Keep moving. This couldn't be it. Could it? It would be so ludicrous. No, it couldn't be it. It wouldn't be fair to Emma.
Oh, Emma.
A gale inflated the skirt of her nightgown, stinging her bare thighs. The unusual hush of the snow-padded city, broken by the grating echo of a plow. She thought of Martin, of all people.
Kandusky, she whispered.
She took a deep breath and exhaled. Then she drew another, deeper breath and held it for longer. Deeper, longer, she kept practicing until she had a sense of the limits of her capacity. When her lungs were swollen with air, Laura, shrouded in snow, cupped her hands around her lips and opened her mouth as wide as it would go. Laura and Emma, a novel, was written by Kate Greathead and read by Madeline Nabe. Editing and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Laura and Emma, a novel, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.